Score, the podcast. The only show taking you inside the studios of the world's most celebrated composers and musical storytellers. Presented by Spitfire Audio.
The name's Kenny Holmes, and you are, sir?
Kraft. Robert Kraft.
Brilliant. And checking in also every week, Composer Carol.
Hi there.
Oh, that's nice. It's a little...
Changing it up.
Quiet.
Hi there doesn't... It's not as good of a shirt, though, as hey, guys.
Composer Carol, who has been crushing it every week with these piano medleys that are insane.
If you're not
checking
it out, you're I don't know what you're doing.
And I think one of the coolest things is that all the composers see them on Twitter or Instagram and write amazingly, thank you, you're incredible.
Yeah.
So,
oh my gosh, I'm touched. But yeah,
that's
thanks,
so cool.
Thanks for sharing. And
you're the favorite of all of our guests here on Score, the podcast presented by Spitfire Audio. And what a jam-packed show that we have for you today. We have a double guest show.
So excited.
We've been trying this out here and there this season, and it's really fun. It's double the pleasure, you know?
I mean, we're focused today on a conversation with one of my all-time favorite composers, Terrence Blanchard, who I've just loved. We've worked together on a couple, but I've just enjoyed so listening to his music.
Yeah, 15-plus films with Spike Lee.
Right.
More than 15. I don't know the exact number, but he's been the composer of at least 15 films, but he's played on so many, including the most recent film on Netflix, Da Five Bloods, and also HBO's Perry Mason. But the list goes on and on for the films Terrence has done: Black Klansman, Harriet, 25th Hour, Malcolm X, Red Tails, Clockers, Summer of Sam, Inside Man, so many great ones. So Terrence Blanchard on the show today. And then also, as we count down...
Alex Lacamoire.
That's right. This Friday is the release of Hamilton, the stage film performance that they're putting on Disney Plus. And we thought this is a perfect time to chat a little Hamilton. We have the music director and conductor of Hamilton, Alex Lacamoire, joining the show today. So a lot to get to. But first, as always, we want to take a second to thank our sponsor, Spitfire Audio, maker of orchestral virtual instruments for film composers used by many of the composers that you hear right here on Score the Podcast.
Yeah, and Spitfire's released two new editions of their best-selling BBC Symphony Orchestra library, including a Discover Edition, which is an entire symphony orchestra at your fingertips for just $49.
Oh, wow.
That's $49. And if $49 is out of your current budget, you can complete a form on the Spitfire website and get it for free. 2 weeks it takes if you fill out that form.
Yeah, we also want to mention Spitfire's new Composer Magazine. There's great chats with many great composers and tours inside studios, including the Newton Brothers talking about Dr. Sleep, which I just watched this weekend finally. Long time coming, and God, it's brilliant. Make sure to watch The Shining first, because there's a lot of Easter eggs, but the music's terrific. There's a lot of callbacks, and Andy and Taylor just crushed it on the music with Mike Flanagan's Dr. Sleep there.
Most importantly to our listeners, we have such a deal for you. 20% off your first purchase at Spitfire. It's good for over 50 different Spitfire libraries. You can use the promo code SCORE2020. It's a limited time offer, so you have to use that promo code SCORE2020 to elevate your music. Stick around after the show today. We're going to play a cue created using the Bernard Herrmann Composer Toolkit.
Very nice. Very nice. So as I mentioned, I watched Dr. Sleep this weekend. It came out on HBO Max. Didn't even know it was coming out, but Mike Flanagan tweeted it, and I was like, that's what I'm doing tonight, and it's rad. I texted Andy Grush, one half of the Newton Brothers, immediately after and said, dude, I don't know what took me so long to see this film and hear what you guys did, but it's fantastic. And I also finally watched Ford versus Ferrari, which is also on HBO Max, and Marco Beltrami and Buck Sanders. Love the music throughout. The performances were great. That's just such a great movie all around. And it took way too long to see these movies. So if you haven't watched those yet, those are my recommendations of the week. And I also went back and watched Old School after interviewing Teddy Shapiro, and it still holds up.
How nice.
It was a nice little Saturday. Went to Bed Bath & Beyond, Home Depot. I don't know. I don't know if we'll have enough time, you know?
You're going out, which is really nice.
No, that's a line from the movie.
Oh.
Actually, pretty nice little Saturday. We're going to go to Home Depot. Yeah, buy some wallpaper, maybe get some flooring. Stuff like that. Maybe Bed Bath & Beyond. I don't know. I don't know if we'll have enough time.
That's funny. Well, we're staying in, and we're certainly hoping our entire audience is having a wonderful opportunity to stay home and stay safe out there. And listen, you know what you can do while you're on lockdown? You can listen to seasons 1 and 2 of Score the Podcast.
That's right.
Think of the possibilities.
Well, I think we should get to it. We have a lot of stuff to talk about here.
Absolutely.
Let's start with our first guest.
I want to be in the room where it happens, the room where it happens.
Joining us now, we're really, really excited because it's a big week. And actually, 2 years ago to this week, I saw Hamilton in Chicago. And Disney Plus, July 3rd, Hamilton is coming out. It's a stage film version. Super exciting to have Alex Lacamoire joining us on the show.
Lacamoire.
And Alex, just so everybody's clear, I don't know how to say it without the O, but you're an igot at this point.
I think my wife says that I have a get.
A get. Okay. He's searching for the Oscar, but he's an Emmy, Grammy, and Tony winning composer, music director, conductor. He does it all. Alex, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's an exciting week for you guys. Tell us how you're feeling about this big release.
Super excited. You know, where we are right now in the world, a live theater is not happening in very many places. And so to get the live experience of Hamilton, that's not happening right now. And we're not exactly clear when that will happen. And there was always a plan for us to release this filmed version of our show. And we were hoping to release it next year in 2021. And as Lynn said, the world turned upside down with the pandemic, and it seemed like a good opportunity for us to bring Hamilton to people if they couldn't come to us. So we will be releasing a recording of the show that we made in 2016. And this was basically, we recorded a live performance of the show in front of a live audience with the cast that we had at the time, just before we started losing a lot of original company members. Like, we were about to lose Lin-Manuel and Pippa and Leslie. And then we, our producer, Jeffrey Seller, had the brilliant idea to capture this cast on camera. Because the story that Jeffrey would tell is that Jeffrey Seller produced Rent back in the day. And he always wished that he had gotten a chance to record that original cast, because that original cast of Rent is, you know, that's a cast of legends, right? Like, those are people that they say, oh my God, I saw Rent with the original cast. That's a very important thing that you saw. So he thought to himself, I would love to capture this original cast of Hamilton, because he had a feeling that people were going to be talking about this original cast in similar tones. So
I would actually like to chime in with two really unimportant pieces of trivia. One, I saw Rent with the original cast.
Amazing.
I also saw Hamilton. And Alex, I wonder if you were involved in the evening I went to see it at the Public Theater. I flew to New York, landed it. It was Hamilton had been open maybe 4 days, and the New York Times review had just run maybe the day before, and I was going to Manhattan the next day. And I'd read whoever, Charles Brantley in the New York Times, you know, this musical is unbelievable, get to the Public Theater, you got to see it. I landed in Manhattan at like 5:30 in the afternoon and called my friend at Warner Chapel.
Oh yeah.
I called him up. I said, hey man, I know it's like 5:30 and the show goes on at 7:30 or 8 at the Public Theater. Is there any possibility you have one theater? And I hear it sold out, and that review yesterday must crush it. He said, hang on, do this. Go to the box office and tell them you are Busta Rhymes. I said, you know, like, I'm kind of a 5'10" white dude. I mean, I'm not like a big rapper dude, Busta Rhymes. He said, just do it. They'll have a ticket for you. I literally went to the Public Theater right from JFK with my bag. I remember hiding it in the Public Theater and went to the guy. And in pure New York fashion, I said, he said, name, please. I said, Busta Rhymes. He didn't blink an eye. He just looked down. He went, Mr. Rhymes, here. Give me the ticket. Next.
Wow.
You got them all in check, I think.
That's really funny.
Busta Kraft.
You know, Busta Rhymes went early in the first week, so maybe like he was supposed to have gone that night and changed his mind. Because he was there for at the Public somewhere in the first week.
So you know what probably happened? I think I went night four of Hamilton.
Yeah.
And sat in a like
front row, right?
Row center.
Or something like that. Yeah.
And
I was just in front row in the first week of the Public.
So probably what happened is he couldn't make it that night. And two nights later, they got him a
ticket.
I think
that's probably what happened, homie.
And they told him, just say you're Robert Kraft.
Well played.
And the guy didn't look up. Or the guy looked at him and said, no, man.
But yeah, I might have been conducting. It was either me or my associate, Kirk Crowley. So
I'm excited because the whole concept of Hamilton being filmed as a stage play mm-hmm. and then presented, it's in a unique job for you. Because usually, I mean, as you know from doing Greatest Showman, I'm sure, or working now on In the Heights, where these are the actual movies, mm-hmm. it's a huge role that you play that is generally unacknowledged in film, not on Broadway, but of the pre-production that goes into getting vocalists recorded and the post-production that goes into making it look like they're singing. So when you're doing a live stage play, what was your role in making Spike's version of the stage play prepared for a movie?
Yeah, so great question. In preparation for the filming of the live performance that you see in the Hamilton film, that was just our natural day-to-day course of events being in Broadway, which is you try to keep the show as well maintained as possible. Meaning, you know, as a conductor, I would sometimes take a show off to watch the show from the house so that I could take notes and give notes about the sound, give notes about cutoffs, give notes about intonation, give notes about phrasing and dynamics, just to try to keep the vocals in shape.
I want to interrupt just to say, if I didn't understand this, our listeners may not. What you were saying, because I sang from the house, so you had a Zoom. Take the night off from conducting?
Yes, thank you for clarifying.
To get into the audience?
Exactly. So instead of like, thank you for clarifying that. Yeah, I would usually conduct the show. The show would occur 8 times a week, and I would conduct most of the shows. And then every once in a while, I would not conduct, and I would have a substitute conductor such that I could actually sit in the audience or by the soundboard and watch the show and take notes and see what the audience was seeing. Because when you're down there in the pilot seat, you're too close and you're listening to everything in headphones. You're not really getting the experience that the audience is getting necessarily. So, yeah, it's about trying to just as I mentioned, trying to keep the show sounding the way as best you think it could sound.
Sure.
So leading up to the recording, the filming of the show, it was just trying to keep the show, as I mentioned, robust and having it sound clean. And then once it was filmed, it was about the post-production. It was about just listening to the mix and having a great team of people to adjust those things and listening to it in a soundstage, listening to it with Tony Volante, our amazing mixer. We had the help of Tim Latham, who mixed our cast album. We had the help of Derek Lee, who engineered our cast album. We had a lot of folks there just working to make the little micro adjustments that are going to be very hard for people outside of us to really know what went into it. But it's all about trying to deliver a true performance of the show that is also, by the way, different than the cast album. Because the cast album is its own experience, right? And that is doing something in the studio where you can really kind of have fun and add some delay on something that you might not have and cut a section that you might normally put in the show. But this was actually the live performance. So what you have is what you have to work with.
It's almost like this concept was predicted for the time. I mean, it's a perfect time for something like this to come out. And you shot this in 2016, which is only a year after Hamilton came out. And this doesn't happen very often with Broadway shows. I'm curious why this particular show, and was this when you noticed that Hamilton was exploding and you're like, we got to get this captured? Or what sparked the idea to do this in the first place and hold it till now?
Yeah, well, the first part of your question, as I mentioned earlier, I think Jeffrey Seller was the person that really got that idea in our heads about trying to capture this original cast before they disbanded and as they were starting to do. And I will say at that point in time, we knew that the show was being received in a very unprecedented way. We knew that the show was making an impact on a lot of people in a way that was very exciting to us because, you know, the show was very visible, you know, like TV shows were making jokes about it in their, you know, the sitcoms, you know, and the cast album was still very popular. There were a lot of tweets, a lot of posts, a lot of articles, a lot of books and stuff, you know, we were in the public eye, and it just felt like we wanted to put this performance in a time capsule because we knew that we didn't want to release it right away. Hmm. It was always in our minds to wait until the time was right. And I think we had always, you know, mentioned the number 5 years, like that always seemed like the right time for us to release it. But you know, it could have been earlier, could have been later. We were just going to kind of feel it out, knowing that it just felt right to not oversaturate what was happening at the time. Because as I mentioned, the show was very popular, but we didn't want to have one more, you know, representation of ourselves.
Yeah. After watching the trailer, even after seeing the show in person, I'm so excited to experience it in a different way, because when you're in a theater, you're in your same seat with your same angle for the whole show. But mm-hmm. because you're able to go in there with, I saw an interview with Lin-Manuel last week about talking about how it was shot and how some days there were audience members in there and then they would clear the audience out and you do another run with cranes and close-ups. And even though it's still on the stage, it's cinematic. How is it going to feel different to watch Hamilton this way versus sitting in a seat at a theater?
Yeah, you explained it perfectly, which is when you're watching a live performance from your seat, you can pick what you want to look at, right? Yes, the lights might be focusing on a particular point on the stage, but you could choose to look left and see what this person is doing and look down into the pit and see what the conductor is doing, whatever. But this is one frame of reference to experience the show. And I gotta give major credit to Tommy Kill, our director, and to Jonah Morin, our editor, because out of these 7 cameras of footage that they captured for 2 runs of the show, plus a whole other day of pickups, as you mentioned, and the pickups weren't the whole show. Those were just targeted scenes. They had to then put together and assemble a way to view the show that still made story sense, that still felt like it captured the essence of the show and focused on the right plot points at the right time and maybe gives enough of the choreography that we feel like we're getting the experience of the show. So I guess all this to say, this is one way of seeing the show, but it's not the only way to experience it, because what I hope this does is that, you know, people will see this movie and get what they would like to get out of it. But it will never, in my mind, replace the experience of being in a theater, watching a live performance happening, seeing other people interpret the piece, hearing the vibration, hearing the music through the air that's vibrating just so for you to be able to feel that bass and that sound and see the sweat coming off of somebody off the stage because they're working and performing right in front of your very eyes. That's a tightrope act in a way. I think that's something that people will miss and will come back to.
Man, just watching you describe it, I can see the passion that you have for live performance. I also like that you called it a movie. I have one tech question about Hamilton, because it's fabulous in this
Please.
Particular iteration of it, and a global question about what you made. The tech question is, you mentioned the cast album, and you don't have to reveal any secrets, but did the singer sing in tune enough for the recording of their vocals live? Because as many people actually suspect but don't know, live singing is rarely completely in tune. In the theater, mm-hmm. you kind of give up a lot of critical nature, you know, listening, because you're watching the performance. On a record, the difference between a great singer and an ungreat singer, particularly in the good old days, is, you know, Ella Fitzgerald sang perfectly in tune, and there were no overdubs or punch-ins, what we do live.
Sure.
For Hamilton, Mike, I wonder, did you have to do a lot of fixing of vocals, or are those good singers that they're live and in tune?
They're amazing, and they're live, and they're in tune. I mean, in this modern age, there is now a little bit of an expectation for vocals to be like a little bit more perfectly, quote unquote, in tune than I think there was, you know, back in the old days.
Because
again, like,
can.
If you go back, listen to old records and whatever, like, you know, Queen, whatever, Van Halen, you listen to that stuff and like, they're not perfectly in tune. You still love it. It's still great. I think to this day and age, you know, people would go back if Led Zeppelin recorded Physical Graffiti today in 2020, someone would tune Robert Plant's vocals. That's just because we're in that mindset where that happens. But I will say this, because of the Hamilton film And all the live mics that were on in the theater all the time, tuning was nearly impossible for them
to film. That's kind of what you're going to hear
is that they, you will see like how good these performers are and how well in tune to your point they were.
It's an underappreciated skill. My other question, the global one, is do you think you've now kind of articulated a new way to do movies, which is you take a great musical. I think actually the answer to the question will be, let's see it July 3rd.
That's one way.
And if it's fabulous and works and is kind of a great way to see it, I think that'll answer my own question. I'm excited by the work that's coming up for you. I saw In the Heights on Broadway.
Thank you.
I absolutely loved it. As I mentioned, I called Lin-Manuel after it and introduced myself and said, let's try and do something together. And he said, I have some other things in the works. Little did I know. I saw Dear Evan Hansen.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you.
So you're now, have you moved from New York City to California? Are you going to be making movies from now on and not working on Broadway and ta-ta the Big Apple?
Well, I still live in New York and Manhattan. I do love it here. I have toyed around with the idea of doing the bi-coastal thing because I was born in Los Angeles. So there are times that I travel out there and L.A. feels like home because of the memories I have of being a kid there. And there's definitely something about the energy and the air and the sunlight that I love about Southern California. That's hard to deny. But I will say this, I have been presented with a lot more TV and film opportunities that I've been going towards, and it's been really fun and illuminating and scary and terrifying and extremely difficult at the same time. But it's a muscle that I'm trying to exercise because it's not one that I don't have a facility with it yet. That is to say, I take on the challenge of trying to score a scene from just a pure creation versus trying to arrange something that is pre-existing. And I want to be able to just draw from that a little bit more quickly. So it's like any muscle. You have to train it. You have to practice. You have to get it stronger. And I'm excited about opportunities to be able to say, oh, yes, I score films and not have it take me the extremely long time that it takes me, you know, with all the self-doubt that I'm riddling myself with, all of that. So that will come with time, hopefully.
When you connected with Lin-Manuel, how early on were you on Hamilton? And I would love to know what you thought of it with your extensive Broadway theater background, a rap about American political history. What were your thoughts on just seeing what he had written?
Your first question is, when did I meet him? It was in 2004, and Hamilton was not even a thought at the moment. Hamilton wasn't a thought until Lin-Manuel went on vacation in 2009, I believe. In terms of what I thought about Hamilton the first time he presented it to me, I will be honest, I admired the verbal dexterity of it, and I saw that the lyrics were, oh my God, that's awesome. But yes, it seemed very outlandish to me. There was a part of me that couldn't tell if he was serious about it or if it was supposed to be tongue-in-cheek. And even if you watch that White House video of us performing it in front of the Obamas, he mentions that he's working on a hip-hop musical about Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton, and everybody starts laughing. And it just seems so hard to put together. It didn't seem like something one could do, but I credit Lin-Manuel for just having that vision to be able to draw some connection that no one else was able to do. I honestly can't think of another person that would have been able to do what he did with the facility that he did. Because, and I say this often, Lin-Manuel is one of these people that his DNA is comprised of all the things that he grew up with. And all the things he grew up with was musical theater of a golden age era, hip hop during the 1990s when it was really like this blossoming, exploding, and everything else in between and after and before. So all those things come naturally to him. He's not putting it on. He's not faking it. He's not, what's the word, trying to imitate something. That's just who he is. So his music comes out with a flow and an ease and an organicness that I don't think could have happened prior to the time that he wrote it, because music needed to evolve, and the speed at which it evolved, and hip hop had to happen when it happened for it to infuse the DNA of this kid who grew up in Manhattan to be able to absorb it in the way that allowed him to write what he wrote. So it's all about timing, right?
It's just a great insight into the process. I really appreciate hearing you describe the authenticity. And also for all of us perspiring creative humans to hear somebody have an idea that at first is laughed at.
Oh, man.
And ends up changing the world. Literally, I don't know how many other works of art that we've been near in the last few years have had the impact of Hamilton. I can't really think
crazy,
of it.
Yeah, yeah,
it's infused the culture at such an enormous level. So, Alex, it's just great to hear all this from you. Yeah. You have on this podcast, there are four of us currently, Kenny, myself, composer Carol, and you, and three of us have a deep attachment to the Berklee College of Music.
I love it.
So great shout out to Berklee.
Yes, please. They're amazing.
Alex, just in closing, regarding this this film coming out July 3rd on Disney Plus, there's a lot of places around the world, people in parts of the country that can't afford to go to see Hamilton. I mean, I think whoever I bought my tickets from paid their mortgage for a couple of months. And it's hard to get a ticket to get to the show. And this is opening up the door for many people who maybe have never seen a Broadway show. For young people who don't even really understand what the concept is. Is there a hope here that you're opening the door to a new generation of going to see live production with the release of this? Because Disney Plus has a lot of young kids tuning in.
They have a lot of young kids, for sure. Well, first thing I'll say is this, you know, it breaks my heart the way people were, you know, hiking up prices, you know, above our top ticket price to make a profit off of something. That really burns me a little bit. And to answer your question directly about what it'll do, you know, only time will tell what people will receive from the message that is being sent from the show. What I do know is that there is something about, for me, and I'll tell you a story, you know, when I was working on In the Heights with Manuel, for me to see that somebody else was using Spanglish to rap and somebody else was using the medium of musical theater to talk about something that I felt so deep, because it was like my story, being a Cuban American growing up and having Latin parents and where are they from? Like, it meant so much to me to have to see myself, or to see a part of myself represented in art in that way, in this medium of theater. And I find that a lot of people feel that with Hamilton, whether it's about representation, you know, you see people who go to the actors and like, oh my God, just to see someone who looks like me up on stage doing what I want to be doing is a source of inspiration in and of itself. And there's a chance that people will be able to see this movie and look at Broadway in a way that inspires them to tell stories and inspires them to perform and be on a stage and live out some career dream that way. So who knows what will happen, but I'm just excited that people will get a chance to experience a work of art that we created, and hopefully that will bring some joy to people.
And hopefully they do this more with Broadway shows, because it's a really cool idea, and it brings it home for people that maybe have too much going on, but they still want to check out the great work. And Hamilton, seriously, if you haven't seen it, on Disney Plus, July 3rd, Alex Lacamoire. Thank you for coming on the show and joining us in, forgive my cheesy joke here, but the Zoom where it happened.
Hey!
Oh, that's not cheesy. Much. That's very good. I think
thank you very much.
I think may
please.
Be a musical that we can all work on, the Zoom where it happens. And Alex, I also want to chime in. Great to talk to you, and look forward to many more opportunities to hear your work.
And go get that O. Go get that O.
Go get that O.
Get it? Get
I appreciate
the O. Get
the O.
Okay. We're done here. This isn't a comedy show. We're going to wrap
things
up. There
we go. Well done. Well done.
Alex, best of luck with everything. And thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me. Thanks so much.
That was great. I'm definitely tuning in on Friday to watch Hamilton. It's been, like I said, 2 years since I've seen it. It's like Broadway coming home.
I'm excited. It's going to be an awesome event. Friday night on Disney Plus. I feel like I'm advertising for them. I'm just excited to see Hamilton and listen to it again.
Yeah. Especially with the original cast. I did not see it with the original cast. So to see
Lin-Manuel
and David Diggs and everybody, it's going to be awesome.
And speaking of geniuses,
yeah,
we have another one coming on our show tonight.
Bringing them through the car wash here, the composer car wash. Coming up after the break, we have Terrence Blanchard. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Blockbuster, the winner of Adweek's Creative Podcast of the Year, returns.
Film is a hobby, not a career.
I know, Dad.
James Cameron?
James Cameron.
A movie for your ears.
James Cameron.
What, me? No.
This isn't what I envisioned.
It's a bad idea, okay?
About the world's most ambitious filmmaker.
It has to be perfect.
Just say, I'm the king of the world.
What? Why would I yell that?
Blockbuster. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Score fans, it's Kenny. We are stoked to be back for season 3, and we couldn't have done it without your support. Be sure to connect with us on social media for the latest guest announcements, video clips, industry news, and more. You can find us on all the social platforms. Twitter is at Score the Podcast, Instagram at Score Movie, and Facebook at Score Movie, or you can just search Score, a film music documentary. Also, please remember to click subscribe on your podcast app. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, leave us a short review. It helps more people discover the show. All right, enough business. Let's get back to it.
Hello, this is Pinar Toprak. You're listening to Score the Podcast. Now let's go back to the show.
Welcome back to Score the Podcast, presented by Spitfire Audio. Super excited for our guest today. He has been alongside Spike Lee on so many great films. He's a 6-time Grammy-winning and Oscar-nominated composer, Terrence Blanchard, joining the show today. Terrence.
Hey.
How you doing, man?
I'm good. How you guys doing?
Doing great.
Oh, it's great to be here with Terrence. And also, Terrence, I know that a lot of interviews may have covered this territory, but as I was listening to a lot of your work, I wondered what the moment was like when you were playing trumpet as a session player on William Lee's score for Do the Right Thing. Was there any molecule in your brain that said, I could do this, I want to do this, I want to be the guy writing the score as opposed to playing on it? Or did that thought come later in the process?
No, I actually had a thought similar to that while we were in the session, because I grew up studying composition and I always wanted to have the ability to write for larger ensembles. I just didn't know how it was going to happen. So when I saw Spike's father writing for orchestra for the film, I literally didn't know that was a job. You know, I always thought that people would just pick records and do needle drops for movies. I don't know why. I just never paid attention to the credits. And when I saw what he was doing, I immediately became interested in it. Just didn't know how it would ever happen. And just as luck would have it, you know, when we were doing Mo Better Blues, Spike heard me playing the piano and then asked to use what I was playing and then asked me to write a string arrangement for it. And that's how it all began.
I didn't know that Spike Lee's dad was a composer.
Oh, yeah.
Did you play with him on previous, like, how did that connection happen? How did you end up playing on Spike Lee's films?
Well, Spike's dad is a great bass player. You know, he played with, I think.
Legendary.
Not Billy Joel. Oh, man, I can't remember. But anyway, it'll come to me. But he was a great bass player, and his aunt was a great classical pianist as well. So when Spike was doing some of the earlier films, they hired a contractor with a great jazz musician named Harold Vick. And Harold had this notion of creating a band of jazz musicians, of the most talented people in the New York area, no matter the age group. So there's actually a video that was floating around for a minute from just us hanging backstage with all of these great jazz musicians at one of Spike's earlier sessions. So I was just called in to play on one of the sessions. And what was crazy about it was, you know, there were two things that happened simultaneously. Lenny White was doing an album of this vocal group, and he wanted Miles Davis to play on the track, but he couldn't get Miles. So he asked me to do it and do it with a Harmon mute, right? Well, at the same time that was happening, I was walking into the session with a Lakers t-shirt on. I had a Lakers t-shirt, Lakers hat.
Oh, no.
Yeah, man. You know, and they had just beaten the Celtics, you know, and Spike, and he looked at me, he goes, Lakers fan. I go, yeah, man, proud of it. And then the track got used in the film. Hmm. Right. And then Spike said, man, that's you playing on? I said, yeah. And that's how he remembered me. So when it came time to do Mo' Better Blues, you know, he asked me to coach Denzel Washington, you know, and then one thing just led to another, man. And we've been working together for about 30 years now.
Did you show Denzel sort of embouchure and different kinds of physical trips that a trumpet player would be used to?
Well, I tried to at first, but he was in L.A. and I was in New York. So we got Oscar Brashear. I don't know if you knew Oscar mm-hmm. Brashear. He's a great trumpet player. We got yeah. him to show Denzel how to buzz while he was in L.A. So when he came to New York, you know, initially I tried to make videos for him, but the videos just didn't get it, you know. Yeah. But what I figured out was, if I would just write out the fingerings on a piece of paper, it gave him something tangible. It's like music to him. You yeah. know, it gave him something tangible where he could practice at his own tempo, you know, and then build up his dexterity that way. The problem became was that he actually knew the fingerings. So if he got caught up in a take of a scene, you know, your natural inclination is to correct your mistake, right? And that little bit of hiccup you could see in a take, right? So what we had to figure out was, listen, man, we clogged up the horn. We allowed him to blow as hard as he could. And we said, don't try to use fingerings. Just sing with the track and do it that way. And that way, man, he just became spot on. He was just nailing it every day.
It's so great. It's one of my favorite or most scary moments in any musical film is when you have an actor you know isn't proficient
mm-hmm.
playing, and there's right. I would squirm and say, I don't understand how they could shoot this. The guy's hands are on the lower half of the piano, and what you're right. doing is the top half. But
well, and Chris Bowers told us, you know, technology's a little better now. They just put Mahershala's head on his body for
Green Book.
For the heavy playing scenes.
Yeah, well,
I don't think that would have worked with me and Denzel. I don't know. Yeah.
Terrence, I'm going to embarrass you by saying that you were so, after listening to all the scores this weekend, it's clear that your destiny was certainly included film composing in addition to all your incredible jazz work, because as I said, listening to the scores, listening to the orchestral compositions, it is so cinematic, it's so natural, and it's also been interesting for me kind of chronologically to see up to Red Tails.
Yes.
And how I hadn't realized, I knew that score, but when I listened in headphones a few days ago, I didn't realize there were electronics involved. I didn't realize that there was a synth bass throughout. So that here you are going from being what I guess Spike could have assumed you're an acoustic analog trumpet player.
Right.
How could he know that you were actually both magnificent orchestral composer, but also had this skill set with electronics that really changed things? Tell me a little bit about what Red Tails was like for you and being at Skywalker. How was that?
First of all, it was an amazing honor to just work with George Lucas, you know, and one of the things we were talking about earlier that shocked me was how similar it was working with him as it was working with Spike, you know. Both very detailed guys, but still guys who respect other people's craft enough to give you room to create, you know. When I got a chance to get up to Skywalker, I was just amazed at the entire thing. And, you know, it's an overwhelming place to be. But the cool thing about George is that, you know, I mean this in the best way. He's kind of like an ordinary dude when you're hanging around him, that it kind of disarms all of that other stuff. You know, next thing you know, we're just concerned about the project, and we're talking about that. But it was a great experience working with him, you know. But I, like I was telling you earlier, I kept looking for direction from him. And he said, man, just make it big. Just make it big, you know. And when he said that, I said, okay, well, you know, I'm going to use everything at my disposal. And what a lot of people don't really know about me is that I grew up listening to all different types of music. You know, I was in the Return of Pharaoh, Mandrill, you know, Parliament Funkadelic, you know, Headhunters, Purple Haze was one of my favorite things to listen to. I listened to a lot of different things, and I still do to this day. So when I got a chance to bring a lot of those elements to bear, man, I just had a lot of fun doing it. And I'm still doing it to this day.
And one of the things that was nice that you said about George and Spike, I read that Spike doesn't give you a lot of, you know, do this, do that.
No, not at all.
What a great compliment. What a great compliment to you.
Yeah, but you know, the thing about it, though, Robert, what it does, man, it makes you work hard, you know, because when any person that you work with gives you that amount of room and has that amount of trust in you, at least for me, I'm the type of person where I'm not going to betray that trust in any way. I'm going to make sure that that person feels comfortable that I have it handled on my end. You know what I mean? So I'm constantly checking twice, dotting my I's, crossing my T's twice, man, and going through things to make sure that things work. When it's time to score, actually, man, I get to the session 2 hours beforehand, you know, just to make sure everything's working. And I'm like a nervous wreck for about an hour and a half. And then that last 30 minutes, I just kind of just relax and have fun and just wait for everybody to show up and then get to work.
Do you have a little team? I just wondered if, you know, Spike has a little crew that's kind of around him a lot.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Usually editor, I'm not sure, music editor. I don't know if he has.
Yeah, Marvin. Marvin yeah. Morris.
Because it used to be Alex Steiermark on some of the early stuff.
That was early stuff, yeah.
I just wondered, do you, when you say you get there 2 hours early, are you pretty consistent with like an engineer or an orchestrator or a crew around you, or is it different per...
No. Well, it's changed. You know, we were using Frank Wolf for a number of years, and now we're using a young guy named Greg Hayes. Mm-hmm. But we try to stay consistent with a lot of, you know, because one of the things with Spike, you know, Spike is very loyal, and he's the type of guy, he's a creature of habit, you know. And when we're doing these sessions, we don't want any new wrinkles, you know what I mean? If we have people that are competent and really great at their job, you know, we're going to make sure that we try to put that team back together as many times as we can.
Amen.
Can you take us back to just growing up? I know, did you grow up in New Orleans?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So there's talk about a place to grow up for music. It's the place. And
I can't tell you how many times as an adult, you know, you reach that point in your life where you start to realize how blessed you are, you know, and I can't tell you how many times I said to myself that I'm so blessed to be from this town, you know, because growing up, just from the sheer notion of what, you know, Rob was talking about, Return to Forever, I grew up in a town where, you know, I could hear like traditional jazz being played in the clubs in the French Quarter. And then I could go home and listen to Miles Davis, Clifford Brown, Thelonious Monk. So immediately I started to understand that there was like a growth. There was a tradition. There wasn't a level that you reach and then you just stop. That was my first recollection of what it meant to be a musician. Then on top of that, the number of people in this town, because I still live in New Orleans now, the number of people, well, I'm bi-coast. I live in both L.A. and here, but I'm here during the pandemic. The number of people who do this because they love it. You know, they've not become big stars, but they're great musicians, they're very creative, and they love what they do. That's my orientation of what it means to be a musician and an artist. It's not about trying to chase down a certain type of career or anything like that. It's really about trying to learn with each project, trying to grow with each project, and trying to give back, man, to the community that has given me so much.
I love that so much. And it's, there's, there's only two cities I've ever been to where you can walk outside at any point in the day and hear music, and it's Nashville and New Orleans. And there's
I'll add a third to that, which is Havana.
Oh, okay.
Woo!
Havana, I mean, you can be walking on any street in Havana and you hear a bass. You know, you think, wait a minute, there's somebody's playing a record that's just a bass solo, and you walk around the corner and there's a dude on the street just...
Let me just tell you this story real quick. So you talk about Havana, right? So I went there with my band, the E Collective. We did a tour there, and it was an amazing tour. When we get to Havana, they took me to a high school where these 15-year-old kids, they had an all-girls jazz band that was amazing. Then they had this other band come up, and a kid was 14 years old playing the alto saxophone like Cannonball Adderley. And when I went over to shake his hand, I was like, man, he didn't speak any English. I didn't speak any Spanish. And I just said, hey, man, you are amazing. And when I was walking back to my seat, I heard the kids giggle and laugh. And I was looking at my road manager, and I said, what happened? He said, man, when you shook his hand, the kid went like, what did I do? You know what I mean? Because that's just what they do every day. We go to Santiago, and they take me to a jam session, right? And a guy got up on stage with an oboe at a jam session. And I'm sitting there going, man, this dude is really brave. Okay, let's just see what's about to happen with this. And when this guy started to play, it was incredible. So the level of musicianship down there is like here. It's like just like what Rob said, man. You know, that was an incredible experience.
We could do a whole show on two aspects of this. The first is exactly what you said, which is you sit down at a piano. You know, I would play the piano in some place, and I have friends that are musicians there, and then as we're getting ready to record, I did some recording in Havana, and then the piano player would come and sit down. He'd play exactly what I played.
Yes.
And then he'd play Beethoven just for laughs to say, you know, I'm also classical. And then he'd play some ferocious montuna. This is the complete musician. These guys were complete players. The other thing that's interesting, and again, this is another podcast, is that New Orleans and Havana have a relationship.
Yep.
And one could even say, and I hesitate, but the clave, which is a very Yoruba, Cuban thing, is also in rock and roll and came up the Mississippi with Bo Diddley. Yeah. And so that's interesting that I didn't realize you'd been to Havana, and I love that. And everybody's going to say, hey, man, let's talk about Terrence, and we will. But I can say to all our listeners.
That's a whole other show.
Get to Cuba. Get the Cuba fast.
Or the podcast, the Cuban Edition, coming soon.
But I also love that you love New Orleans, man.
And let me just tell you this, too. If you say, this is one of the things our Blakey taught me about the difference between Latin music and jazz. He said they're the same, just on the other side of the beat. He said, if you're talking about Latin music, you go da da ding da da ding da da ding da da ding, right? And in jazz, it's da da ding da da ding da da ding, right? I'm simplifying both of them, obviously, but essentially, that's one of the things that's like really fascinating. And when I was in Havana, I got really upset and I got pissed off because I saw that connection between Havana and New Orleans. Readily, it was right. You could see it in architecture. You could see it everywhere, right? And I was upset because this is a place that's 45 minutes from my home by flight, and it took me until I was 50 years old to get there. And when I got there, I saw people that looked like me. I saw people that had the same kind of passion for music. It was a watershed moment, man. That trip changed my life.
We can go forever, and it's funny you say about.
I know. I'm sorry. Yeah.
No. I love that, and I've been many, many times, and I go through Miami, and you go up from Miami Airport and down in 32 minutes, and you say, "How is this possible? This is this close."
We were getting into to Terrence's past, and I want to touch that before we go anywhere else. So you're a young man growing up in New Orleans. Are you inspired by the music around you? Are you in a musical family? How did you get the bug?
Well, it's funny. You know, when I was a kid, man, I grew up in a household where there was music everywhere. My grandfather played guitar. My mom's sister played piano and taught voice. My dad loved operatic music and was a baritone. And my grandmother had a piano. When I was a little kid, I was about 5 years old, I would always sit at the piano when I was over there, and I'd try to play Batman. And I would just play the rhythm on the piano and hit any notes. And, man, they were like, if this dude is going to do this, can we please get him some lessons? So at least he can play something that we could actually listen to. So I started taking lessons on the piano when I was 5 years old. And we lived in a double, right, double home. And my piano teacher lived on the other side of the house, so I could never miss a lesson, man. It was frustrating when I was a little kid. You know, your Saturdays, man, you don't want to be stuck in a room. Like,
is growing up in New Orleans, is it standard to take music lessons? It seems like it's just part of the culture.
Well, for a lot of people here, it is. It's not for everyone, but for a lot of people, a lot of kids here, they see what's happening with the music in the streets, and they all want to be a part of it. So the sad part about it is that there were some legislators that actually thought about taking music out of the school system after Hurricane Katrina. You know, and we really had to fight that, because we were like, are you crazy? You know, this is one of the things, and especially at that time, because there were a lot of kids who couldn't put into words what they were going through. And we knew music was the thing that was going to help them heal from that situation.
So you're taking lessons as a young kid. And then at what point are you go through the school system, you're playing in the bands, and were you in a band? When did it start to become something where you were like, this could be what I'm going to do as I get older?
Well, you know, around the time I was in junior high school, man, I started playing keyboard, actually, in a pop band, you know, because that's where I started. I started playing piano before I started playing trumpet. So I was a keyboardist in a pop band. We played dances all around town. And then I would actually started playing some jazz gigs with some musicians here on my horn. And then I started to realize, I wasn't going to be the stellar football athlete that I thought I was, being 5'10", you know, and not too muscular. But it started to take on a life of its own. And once I became serious about it, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, doors just start to open, you know, summer camps. My aunt would put me in summer camps from the time that I was in fifth grade in elementary school. That's where I met Winton and Branford. You know, we were friends throughout our entire time growing up. New Orleans is that type of town where all of the musicians here, we're kind of like family, you know, because it's a small town.
Yeah, that's so nice.
So you're now this incredible, renowned trumpet player, but it all goes back to piano. And I'm wondering what inspired the transition. At what point were you piano player turned trumpet player, and why?
Man, there was a guy named Alvin Alcorn. You can't see it in my studio, but I have his picture on my wall to remind me of it. When I was in fourth grade in elementary school, he brought a traditional jazz band to my elementary school to, you know, just play for us, right? And I never forget, there was something about him playing the trumpet. The vibrato, it had a vocal-like quality to me in my mind. That's what I kept thinking about when I was a kid. The funny part about it was, you know, remember I told you I live in the double, and we didn't have a piano, so I would always have to go over to my grandmother's house to practice, right? Well, just as I came home to say that I wanted to play the trumpet, my dad had just gotten me a piano to put in the house, you know? Yeah, that was, my dad forgot about his religion that day. It was...
Did you ever have a chance really to go funny, back man. To Mr. Alcorn and tell him how much influence that day had on him? Did you ever see him again and tell him?
I did, but you know, I didn't get a chance to say, I'll tell you what happened. Like I said, New Orleans is such a small town, man. We're coming down on the off ramp on the highway. We get to a traffic light. My dad is driving. I'm still a young kid. I'm in elementary school. And I go, Dad, that's the guy. That's the guy. He's the reason why I want to play the trumpet. And my dad goes, oh, that's Al. And I'm like, you know him? They roll down the window, and he goes, Al. And he goes, hey, Al, how you doing? And they're talking real quick. And he goes, hey, Al, my son wants to play the trumpet. You think you could teach him? And I got really excited, you know, like, oh, man, I'm going to study with this guy. And he goes, no, he's got to learn how to do that for himself.
Oh, shoot.
And I was crushed, man. I was crushed. But when I got older, I said, you know what? That was probably the best thing for me to hear, you know, that nothing was going to be given to me. If you're going to do this, you got to work for it.
That's so interesting. And it just reminds me, every great musician has something burning inside that says, you know, I'm going to do this or I'm going to die trying. It's,
yeah.
We all know that there's certain people come and go, you know, I'm thinking of doing a couple things, thinking of doing banking or maybe being an agent or maybe being a musician. I just say, you know what? It just doesn't make any sense. If you're going to be a musician,
there's no questioning it, right?
Yeah. I wanted to get back to Klansmen just before we take a minute here, because I'm really interested in your use of the guitar and how you, I know you came to that. It's funny. I've been thinking a lot about, strangely enough, Ernie Isley.
Oh,
it's a long
yeah.
story. And, yeah. And Jimi Hendrix and the whole, mm-hmm. you know, Hendrix was in the Isley band. But I know that on Klansmen, there was a moment there where you maybe thought about Hendrix or using guitars. Just, first of all, it's an incredibly soulful melody, and it's interesting you chose to articulate it on guitar. What was there those kind of moments with composers? It's very hard to know, but you know, do you wake up in the middle of the night and go, I got it, it's not no. trumpet, it's guitar?
Yeah, well, for me, it's when I saw the first clip with John David with that afro and that leather jacket and those bell bottom pants. Man, I went right back to my childhood in the 70s. And the Black Panther movement was really strong. You know, there was a lot of things going on. There was a few dudes in my neighborhood, man, who had just come back from the war. And some of those guys were shell-shocked and were suffering with mental illness. We didn't know that at the time. We just thought that they were crazy. But, you know, the older I became, I started to realize what was going on with them. And there's just something that struck me about Jimi Hendrix playing the national anthem. And I kept saying to myself, his interpretation of it to me was one of the most patriotic things that I've heard. You know, a lot of people will disagree with that. But for me, he was being honest, you know, about what he was feeling when he played it. And it, to me, it was kind of similar to Colin Kaepernick kneeling, you know, in that, you know, the thing says, you know, all men are created equal, you know, but that's not. It there should be an addendum, but all men aren't treated equal, you know. And when he played that and I heard it, I said, you know what? That's got to be the sound for this movie, where you have this ordinary person who did an extraordinary thing. You know, this guy wasn't looking to be an activist, you know. He was just doing his job. And when he stumbled on this thing about the Klan, he just went with it. And I got a chance to meet him, and it was an amazing thing meeting him, because, you know, when you meet guys like that that do things like that, you expect them to be 7 feet tall and full of muscle and everything. No, he was an average guy who, like I said, did an extraordinary thing, which made me question what is it that I'm doing and what can I do, you know, to help further the cause.
I liked one of the comments under, I was watching a scene that I found on YouTube of Black Klansmen, and one of the comments reminded me of the year that you were either lucky or unlucky to have Black Klansmen nominated for an Academy Award, because the comment did not mince words. It said, Terrence should have won the Oscar for Black Klansmen. Then it said a word that I won't repeat because we have a family audience sometimes, but it said yeah. blank Black Panther.
Oh,
so,
wow.
And I didn't remember that the energy around Black Panther was sort of sweeping up awards. Mm-hmm. And there you had just this magnificent score. But I liked reading at one point that you said you had no, you know, you didn't go into any movie, of course, thinking, oh, man.
No,
this is my Oscar bid.
No.
Next score.
Yeah. I mean, because even with the nomination, even with the Five Bloods, it never happened in the past. So I wasn't looking forward to it happening at any time soon. So when it did, it was such a shock to the system, and it was a great time. I was just happy to be there, man. And the thing that I'll say is that, you know, With Nicholas Britell and I'm losing my brain out. We had a great time throughout the entire Oscar run. We became great friends, man, and we were all rooting for each other, you know?
Who else was up there? It was
Ludwig.
Ludwig, Nick Ludwig, Bertel, Bertel, you.
And man, come on, you know who I'm talking about.
Was it Despla?
No, he was at, he didn't show up. He was nominated, but he didn't show up. He's going to kill me. He's going to kill me.
Composer Carol has got it on the edge of her fingertips here.
Yeah, because he's a great guy. He's funny as hell, too.
I wonder. They're all funny. Nick Bertel is funny. Nick Bertel is
respect.
Big shout out.
Let's take a step back on the timeline again now. So you played trumpet on a couple Spike films. And then when did you step into the role? And what was that conversation like? How did you become the guy to score his films?
Well, we were doing some pre-records for Mo' Better Blues. And I was, at the same time, I was working on my first solo project for Columbia Records as an artist. And and we had taken a break, right? I was going through an embouchure change, man. I didn't have much endurance at the time. So we took a break. And I sat at the piano and I started playing this melody of something that I was working on. And Spike heard it and walked by and he goes, "Hey, man, what is that?" And I said, "It's a tune that I'm writing for an album that I'm going to do for Columbia Records. It's called Sing Soweto. It's for all of the kids that were massacred there." And he said, "Man, I love that melody." He said, "You think I can use it?" And I said, "Sure." I didn't think nothing of it. We recorded it just as an a cappella trumpet piece at the time. And then it was later on after he started editing, he changed his mind about just having to just be solo trumpet. He asked me, he said, "Hey, man, you think you can write a string arrangement for it?" And I said, "Sure." And I called my composition teacher up and said, "Man, I got to write a string arrangement. So what do I do?"
Oh, wow.
I wrote the arrangement, brought it in, and I'll never forget it, man. Bill Lee, I gave the music to Bill Lee, and Bill Lee goes, "Hey, man, you wrote it, you conduct it." And this is a story I always tell kids. I said, because it brought me back to my high school arts training when I was at the arts high school here. Perfect. I had to go back and say, "Okay, I remember one is here, two is here, three is here, four is here." So at least I had that part done. This hand didn't know what to do, you know, but at least I could keep everybody on beat. And we did the take. And afterwards, Spike came out and he just said, "Hey, man, you got a future in this business." And I said, "Oh, thank you, man." And I didn't think none of it because I was riding off the high of having 70 musicians play something that I'd written. Right. And it goes to show you how the universe works. So we were at old BMG Studios in New York, and I walked up the hallway to go to the men's room, and there was a mastering room right there across from the men's room, and there was a guy in there mastering The Rite of Spring, Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring. And you talking about, man, like just checking your ego at the door. Like, I was on this huge high of like hearing this orchestra, and then I walked down the hall, and when I heard that, I said, "Oh, my God, I got a lot of work to do." And then Spike called me to do Jungle Fever, you know, after that. And it's just been a wonderful working relationship ever since.
But did you at that
were
moment?
Were you shocked, though?
With Jungle Fever, did you have that same moment of how do I write a string arrangement? Did you have that moment of how do I write a film score?
Oh, definitely. And the wild part about it, a lot of people don't know, is that at the time, man, there was a lot of piracy going on in New York, right? So, as a matter of fact, I remember coming down Canal Street one day and the feds raided this place that was manufacturing. And it was funny because they jumped out of a white panel truck and I was parked right behind them at a light. And I thought they were coming for me. You know, it was crazy. No. About 15 officers jumped out of this truck and raided this place. But at the time, everybody was freaked out about films getting released early because, you know, they were being sold on the street like months before they were released. So Spike didn't give me the film for Jungle Fever. He just gave me a sheet and said, "This scene is this long, this scene is this long." And I tried to do my best. And at the time, I really didn't know much about orchestration. So I remember after doing it, it's like, you know, I always tell my students whenever I have a session, for some reason, after every session, there's a moment of clarity that becomes the next session. You know, the thing, the do's and don'ts.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah.
So you scored your first full-length film with no picture.
Yes. Yes.
That's insane.
Well, I didn't think. Yeah, I mean, you know, now, I mean, looking at it, it was a challenge, you know. But that's why when we did Malcolm X, you know, I told Spike, I said, Spike, you know, I understand what's going on, bro. But look, man, I'm going to keep everything secure. And look, I get it. I understand what he was, because, you know, one of the places that he was working at when he was doing it, man, I'm telling you, it was crazy back then. There were like major films being sold on the street prior to release.
Well, I think just before we take a little break and come back with Terrence Blanchard, I must share it, that in that moment of all the films being stolen, I had the experience of actually finishing Avatar.
Oh, wow.
And being very concerned the studio was about piracy.
Yes.
And I went to the premiere, and then my family and I, we had a friend who was working in Phnom Penh, Cambodia. He'd started an orphanage, and after the premiere, we flew to visit him and do some work. And we got there, and the very first day we're walking in Phnom Penh, and this kid comes up to us with a basket full of DVDs.
Yeah.
He had Avatar for sale.
And that's something.
I'd been at the premiere maybe 48 hours before, and it was 75 cents. Yes. And I thought, well, here's a $200 million movie that somebody has already figured out a way to steal.
Yeah. It didn't affect the box office.
That 75 cents, I kept it in my pocket. I brought it right back to Fox and threw it in a basket.
We're going to take a quick break. Much more to come with Terrence Blanchard. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey there, fans of Score the Podcast. I'm David W. Collins, creator and host of The Soundtrack Show for iHeartRadio. Like you, I love Score the Podcast, and The Soundtrack Show is the perfect complement if you're passionate about music for film, TV, even video games and theater. Each week, I do a deep dive into some of the greatest scores of all time, as well as some fan favorites, and talk about why the music moves us from a character and story point of view. We also learn fascinating behind-the-scenes stories and share the history and background that brought each piece of music to life. It doesn't matter if you're a musician or not. Music is a language that we all understand. And through our love of movies like Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, Back to the Future, or even classics like Casablanca or Psycho, we can gain a deeper appreciation for how composers are speaking to us through music, explaining why we have such a powerful reaction to the images on screen. The Soundtrack Show is available on Apple Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Nicholas Bertel. You're listening to Score the Podcast. And now, let's get back to the show.
Welcome back to Score the Podcast, presented by Spitfire Audio. We're joined by Oscar-nominated and Grammy-winning composer Terrence Blanchard. Latest film, The Five Bloods, on Netflix, another Spike Lee joint.
Terrence, we found out the name, and maybe we should come back. Carol researched it. Here are the five contenders for that year, which might have been 2018. Black Panther, Black Klansman, Beale Street, Isle of Dogs, Mary Poppins, Mark Shaman.
Mark Shaman.
And you're going like this. You're going like this. You say he's really funny. And I thought, who? And then, one of the funniest guys ever. Boy, did I have some amazing times with Mark Shaman. Amazing.
Didn't he win the Golden Globe, too?
Oh, you know what? I think he did.
Because Ludwig didn't win it.
Yeah, I think he did. But, you know, we were at the BAFTAs, man. And, you know, in the BAFTAs, they combine the songs with the score. So, you know, and we were up against Lady Gaga, you know, and we went for the trip, man. We knew what was going to happen. And it was so funny, man, because I could see Mark across the hall. I mean, in the concert hall. And when our category came up and they called them as the winner, Mark looked over at me and he goes,
"Loser." That's funny. He is a very funny man. I've known him a long
time. That seems like the thing to. Didn't John Powell tell us that Hans Zimmer did that to him when Social Network won the Oscar? I feel like that the exact same thing. He did the L. Terrence, I'm curious how your relationship with Spike Lee has changed over the time you've worked with him. How is it different working with him? Are you guys are you even verbal anymore? Do you need to even speak? I mean, when you work with someone that long, it seems like you probably get a vibe of what they're looking for.
Yeah, you know, it's been an interesting relationship, Kenny, because I tend to think it's, well, not that I think, I know. It's been a beautiful thing watching both of us grow, and Barry too, who's the editor, you know, because I've been telling people all along, the wonderful thing about working with Spike is that he really loves making movies, man. I mean, you know, there's just no way around it. I mean, and he is a historian, you know, he knows a lot about film, and I get inspired working with him every time. You know, we were doing the Oscar run for BlacKkKlansman when he told me he was getting ready to start shooting The Five Bloods. And I'm like, damn, brother, take a break, man. You know, do something. And he got to work, and I'll never forget when he sent me the first cut. My reaction was like, oh, my God. You know, this guy's done it again. And then the next thought is like, you know, that's like getting a pass from Michael Jordan on the court. And you're all alone by yourself. You got to take the shot. You have to take the shot, and you got to make the shot. You know what I mean? And that's what I felt like, because I watched Del Roy's performance, Clark Peters, everybody. And the cinematography, I thought it was just gorgeous. And I'm sitting there saying to myself, there's no way that I'm going to allow the music to be the weak link in this chain, because everybody's done such an amazing job.
Yeah, and it's cool that this film, you know, in a time where the theaters are shut down and everything, something like Netflix, you're probably getting a lot of eyes on this film. Are you noticing that a lot of people are seeing the film?
I've had so many friends and colleagues like hit me up on social media, text me on my phone about enjoying the film, and it makes it in this weird, crazy moment that we're living in. It brings a lot of joy to my heart that we've created something that can take people away from the craziness just for a little bit, you know, and also make people reflect, you know, because a lot of people have been saying that the film is a timely film. And my answer to that is that it's not a timely film. It's just that these issues that we've been dealing with haven't been really confronted. You know, we could have done this movie last year and people would have said the exact same thing, you know. But having said that, I think I feel blessed and I feel honored to have worked on this project and to be working with people like Spike and like Del Roy and all of those guys who love what they do and really great at
it. I just thought it was amazing. I wanted to ask a little bit, and Kenny and I were talking about this. Just curious, I know that Spike wanted the Marvin Gaye material. I'm just curious, had he spotted the film with those moments and you had to write around them, or was it done together?
No, he already had it in there. You know, one of the things about Spike, man, is that not only is he a film historian, man, he is a serious music lover. You know, he loves music, you know, and he knows more about it than he ever will admit to. He has great ears. I'll never forget, we were doing a session one time and the whole string section is playing, and he goes, and I was getting ready to hit, I was telling the engineer to say, okay, stop. And as I was doing that, Spike goes, you know, hey man, the violas are out of tune. And I'm like, yeah, the viola. I'm like, say that again. I'm like, wait a minute, hold on, what'd you just say? I'm like, how did you hear that it was the violas between the entire section? You heard the violas out of
tune? That's stunning.
Yeah.
Does he play? Is he a musician at all?
Well, his father's a great composer. You got to figure he's got some DNA that says music.
As a matter of fact, at that point, I told him, I said, don't ever tell me you don't know anything about music ever again.
Ah, perfect.
Please. Yeah.
How do you characterize the importance of Spike Lee in American history? Just with his filmmaking and the subjects he tackles?
I'll put it to you like this. When we were doing Inside Man, it was right when Hurricane Katrina hit. And I had an apartment in L.A. because I was teaching at USC at the time. And, you know, me and my family, we evacuated with my two youngest kids to L.A. Couldn't find my mom for 2 weeks. Mm. Found her, brought her to L.A., put her in an apartment across the courtyard from ours, and Spike normally flies me to New York to spot. And he said, listen, man, you don't need to be away from your family right now. He said, you stay with your family. I'm going to come to you, and we're going to spot in L.A. I'm like, okay, good. I said, I appreciate that. He walked into my apartment, and he said, I'm going to do a documentary on those levees, and I'm going to allow those people the chance to say what they have on their minds, and I'm going to give them a chance to speak. And it was at that moment that I realized how important this guy is, because not only is he a great artist, but he's a great humanitarian, you know. And in his humanitarian life, he understands that with his platform, he can give voice to the voiceless, you know. And I have never seen anything done on New Orleans as comprehensive as what he had done.
When the levees broke?
Yes, because you got to remember, you know, and it's an racial thing, unfortunately. We have all of these different pockets of variations of this New Orleans culture. So sometimes there would be a documentary on this part, there would be a documentary on this part. Spike didn't look at it like that. He included everybody in his piece. And when I saw that, and I saw what it did to the spirit and the souls of the people who live here and were from here, it was an amazing thing. And then it also allowed people around the world to get a glimpse of what was going on here. So for me, he's a very important figure because he has this fictional world where he creates these movies that help illustrate his humanity. But then also in his documentary life, he'll actually go out and give voice to the voices. Same thing happened with Four Little Girls. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I think he's an extremely important person.
It's interesting how all that work and in any artist's life, but in Spike's, it's going to be cumulative. It brings us to this moment, and it's, you know, it might have not had an impact that was global at that moment. It was muted. It was seen. And now we come to today where all of his work, as I'm going through your work and looking at what Spike has done, edition, also Casey and Harriet. And some of these films that come up, you realize the house was being built, and it was being built by filmmakers. And though it might not have had the impact at that moment, and it's interesting how The Five Bloods actually shows up now, and the Marvin Gaye song, you know, when the lyrics come up on my screen, because I put subtitles on, and I read the lyrics, and I realize what Marvin Gaye was saying, I just, things don't always happen in the time they should, but, you know, this is, that's the right film and the right song. I think we were both interested.
Well, I have to tell you, I don't mean to cut you off, but I have to tell you, you just illustrated exactly, I just did an op-ed for NPR, and you just illustrated exactly what I was what I was trying to say. And the thing is, you know, the thing that I was saying was that, because I was doing an interview about The Five Bloods and somebody was talking about, you know, what's going on and how many people love the song. And then I thought about it and I related it to social injustice in that, you know, there are well-meaning people all around this planet who love the songs and can really sing the melodies with the same inflection as Marvin Gaye, which will make you think they really understand it, but don't really understand what the words are, you know? And sometimes it takes people a while to really grasp what is really happening with the words. And I think this moment in time with George Floyd's death, this is a moment in time where people are waking up to what the words actually are in the song. And I'm just talking about in our culture and this American culture where we've been, you know, trying to do the best. Well, I won't say all of us, but a lot of us have been trying to do the best that we can, you know. So it's a beautiful moment to see how out of this tragedy, a lot of people have awakened to what has been going on for decades, you know. And it's been doing my heart a great, it's been blowing me up, man, watching all of these young people out in the streets fighting for injustice, you know, fighting for what America has promised all Americans. You know what I mean? It's a beautiful thing to witness.
Is that one of the reasons why you chose to do it a cappella. First off, I had never even heard that song like that before. I don't know if that had that been out there like that anywhere,
no.
But the fact that you didn't have the music around it to really put the lyrics on display.
No, that was a Spike decision, and I think he did it exactly for that reason. You know, I think the backdrop of the war, what we were talking about earlier, these guys fighting for the rights for people they don't know, only to go back and not have the same rights as the people they were fighting for. And then the person who was fighting for their rights was killed, you know, but they were still professionals. You know, it's an amazing thing. And I think, you know, by making it an a cappella piece, it gave, like you said, it gave you a chance to really focus on what's going on. Because when he says, mother, 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 there's far too many of us dying, you know. Brother, 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 there's far too many of us dying. Mother, 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 there's far too many of you crying. It's powerful.
You know, Marvin Gaye is really, really laying it down with those lyrics. I mean, it's just quite a remarkable song, more than I ever knew. And it's funny when you're talking about it, seeing how many people say, oh, honey, I love this song. Let's slow dance, not realizing it's incredibly political. But you've got so much great stuff coming up. I mean, Perry Mason debuted last week.
Yes.
And is now in full swing. Maybe a couple weeks ago.
I'm into it. Yeah, I'm into the new Perry
Mason. It's a great show.
You know what I heard in Perry Mason? And I thought, I wonder if Jerry Goldsmith somehow showed up in a room near you. Because it might be just the solo trumpet feeling and the dark streets of Chinatown. But it's a nice room to be in, which is the Jerry Goldsmith room. But I thought, ooh, Terrence, either overtly or maybe it's just those pictures, I felt a little Chinatown coming through.
Well,
kind of a trip.
Well, you know, the thing is, I've loved great scores, man. You know, so it's all possible because, you know, that's one of the, when I did my album, I did an album called Jazz and Film, and we recorded Chinatown.
Yeah. Oh, I remember. You know?
You know what I mean? So it's possible. You know, for me, what I try to do with Perry Mason is to try to create something fresh, but bring in some of the sonic elements of the period, you know, and do something a little different.
Are you playing? There's a lot of piano and trumpet on display. Is that you playing everything?
Me, but I'm playing both. I'm not playing. We, you know, during this COVID-19 period, we had to find guys who could record at home.
Sure.
So we had a bunch of guys who recorded drums, bass, and the horns, saxophones, and the strings in the studios, and I did everything else, including the piano and trumpet.
Oh, that's so nice.
Well, it's definitely a great show, and it's, you know, anytime you're on an HBO series, they don't miss very often. So I'm excited to see how that unfolds.
When I saw this show, I was amazed because, and I've been telling people, I said, this is not your dad's Perry Mason. You know what I mean? Just wait. First episode is just wait till you, it's a great show.
It also shows growth as a composer because if I'm not mistaken, I mean, when I first heard the end title, I thought, you know, it's almost like my CD player is skipping or, you know, but I realized it was a sample that was rhythmic.
Yes.
And plus, it just shows all the coolness of electronics, plus kind of an acoustic band.
Yeah. You know that first sound.
Yeah. What is that? A sample of?
It's a sample of something that's in Omnisphere that I use.
Oh wow!
But I got the idea because that truck, man, is so rickety at the beginning of the show.
Nice. That's so cool. I think, Terrence, we just wanted to ask also a little bit about the Charles Blow book that you're going to be working on. I mean, I've been interested in hearing you. I don't know if we even got it on the podcast, but earlier saying that your father listened to opera. You have your second opera coming up for the Metropolitan, correct?
Yeah, I'm excited about it. I still wonder about how I got here, you know, because my father loved opera, and I always said, you know, he's probably up in heaven looking down at me going, I told you so. You should listen to me years ago. Yeah. But I've been blessed, man, because this whole journey started with Opera Theater St. Louis when they asked me to do Champion in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
That's when it premiered. And, you know, they said, well, we want you to do another one. And, you know, my wife found the book of Charles Blow's life, Fire Shut Up in My Bones. And it's been a beautiful journey, you know, because when we premiered it in St. Louis, those guys did an amazing job. And it's such a different experience than writing film, because in film, I'm reacting to something that I'm looking at. There's a stimulus on the screen that's you know, inspiring me to write. Here, it's just a libretto in my mind. And it's an amazing thing to sit in a room for 2 or 3 years and put this together and then watch people walk around the stage and singing these lines. It's an incredible experience.
I know it's Casey and... Casey Lemons
did the libretto.
Oh, she did.
She adapted it from Charles Blow's book.
And this is scheduled. I know it's kind of up in the air, but what, 2022, 2023, something?
Yeah, 21-22, I think, is the 21-22 season.
So,
yeah.
For all you sports fans out there, we are blessed to have Terrence here, who it's hard, you know, it's like whatever day it is he making a record with E Collective? Is he scoring a major release on HBO or in the theaters? Seriously. Is he writing an opera? Is he teaching at UCLA? That's a full life.
Yeah, you have so many things going on, but you always have time for Spike. Has there ever been a point where you had to put something on hold for him? I mean, how do you balance all of these different projects?
You know what, Kenny, man, it's been amazing in how things work. Look, knock on wood, dude. I've been very blessed that things have fallen into place, you know, perfectly in my career. There were a couple of times where I had to move some concerts around, obviously. But it wasn't a huge deal because those things were just easily rescheduled. But I've been blessed in that way, you know. And, you know, look, Spike is the dude that got me into this, man. So whenever he calls, I have to make sure that I'm there for him just the way he's been there for me.
I love that. I think it's one of the great attributes of having a relationship with a director is that you actually have this kind of... First of all, you have a nonverbal way of talking to each other and speaking, but he knows that he doesn't have to think, wow, I got to find a new composer for this. He's found the composer.
Thank you.
Before we let you go, I had one question that I have to ask you, and you kind of addressed the Spike Lee NBA fan fandom when you talked about the Lakers, but have you been to a game with Spike? Have you experienced that?
When I lived in New York, man, he turned me into a Knicks fan. And this was back during the glory days of Patrick Ewing, John Starks, and all of those guys. And I tell his story, and I know he doesn't remember it. He wasn't even paying attention. But we're sitting on the floor, man, and I had a box of Cracker Jacks, and I just put him down like this. And he jumped up and said, "Take him, Pat," and kicked the Cracker Jacks all over the court, man. And the ref came over to me, like, really upset. Hey. And I was getting ready, and I was like, no, but he's the reason why. That's where I got my ticket from. I'm like, yeah, all right, man, my bad.
That's a great colleague.
But here's the thing. You know, he knows that I'm a serious NFL fan, and the Saints are my team, right? So he came down after Hurricane Katrina when the Saints played that first game after the hurricane. He was actually here walking around with a New York Jets jersey on,
no
man.
Way.
Yeah. And
my man.
Yeah. And it was funny because I didn't see him and my phone kept going crazy. Your man's here walking around with a Jets jersey on. I'm like, and I'm texting. I was texting. I'm like, hey, bro, you can't do that down here, bro. You can't do that down here. No. But, you know, that's when it comes to football, we don't talk football much because he's a New York fan.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well, Saints, so, you can have,
we haven't even talked basketball that much lately.
Hey, listen, so. I used to go to Yankees games, and there'd be one guy walking into the bleachers in a Red Sox uniform, and the police would actually lift him out and say, "Come with us," because it was too dangerous. By about the fifth inning, with enough beer, you know, the fights broke out. But
man, saying that, yeah.
Just I love can feel that just
the Cracker Jacks.
Just love here, yeah, man. That's so
fantastic. Yeah.
Well, Terrence, thank you so much for taking the time all the way joining us from New Orleans. We really appreciate you coming on the show. And The music of Perry Mason is available now on Water Tower Music, and new episodes every Sunday on HBO. And also make sure to go watch The Five Bloods on Netflix. That is out now. And so is The Score, right? On all music platforms.
The Score is out as well. It's a beautiful story. Thank you guys, man. Hey, man, it's been great. Hey, Robert, it's been great seeing you. I've been too long.
Terrence, too long, but we're gonna figure that out. We're going to remedy that. Yeah. So thank you so much.
Fantastic. Man. And a reminder to our listeners to follow us. There's a number of ways. Instagram, Score Movie, Twitter, at Score the Podcast, Facebook, Score a Film Music Documentary. Send us your questions to scorethemailbox@epicleft.com. We'll try to get those answered on the show. Robert, take it away.
Hey, Terrence, just a great pleasure. I'm going to go listen to more Terrence Blanchard after this podcast just because it makes me feel so good. So
thank you, man.
Cheers, and we'll see you next week.
All right. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Hey, Score listeners, we're so grateful for the support of Spitfire Audio. They collaborate with people like Hans Zimmer and the Bernard Herrmann Estate to build sample libraries that elevate your music. You're about to hear a musical demo of what that sounds like.
And remember, as an exclusive to Score listeners, yes, you Score listeners are special. And you're so special that Spitfire Audio is offering 20% off your first order. That's good for over 50 of their libraries.
Yeah, just go to spitfireaudio.com, enter the promo code SCORE2020 so they know we sent you. Now we're going to play you a little clip from the Bernard Herrmann Composer Toolkit. Here's some of the different sounds they offer in that package. Check it out. Again, just go to spitfireaudio.com, use the promo code SCORE2020 and save 20% off your first order with Spitfire products. We will see you next week. Where, Robert?
On your radio dial, or more appropriately, on Score the Podcast.
I'm leaving that. That's great.